This UCSD-TV program is a presentation of University of California Television for educational and non-commercial use only.
Our next speaker is Rob Engel, who won the Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences in 2003. For methods of analyzing economic time series with time-varying volatility. From an early age, Rob seemed destined to have a career in science. His father was a chemist, and when Rob got interested in building and shooting off rockets, his father encouraged him to vary the rocket's ingredients and to keep a record of what difference that made. While a senior in high school, Rob's project on X-ray transmission won first place in the Philadelphia Science Fair. Rob also had a strong interest in music and played the tuba and string bass while in junior high and high school. And this interest continued into college and graduate school, where he played in those schools' orchestras. Rob went on to major in physics as an undergraduate and entered the physics PhD program at Cornell. But Rob made a mistake of taking an economics elective course in his senior year in college, which changed his career path. After 1 year of physics at Cornell, he switched to the economics PhD program, and as they say, the rest is history. Rob earned his PhD from Cornell in 1969 and accepted his first academic appointment at MIT, which arguably had the top economics department at that time. In 1974, while I was serving as department chair here at UCSD, Clive Granger told me that there was this bright young econometrician at MIT whom we should try to hire. When I learned that Rob had earned his bachelor's degree from my alma mater, Williams College, and was in fact a fraternity brother of mine, I figured this guy must be good. So we went all out to recruit Rob, and we were successful in attracting him to UCSD. Rob and Clive became lifelong collaborators, and they shared the Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences in 2003. Aside from his many academic accomplishments and honors, two things impress me about Rob. One is that he has so many interests outside of his professional life. To give just one example, he has had a successful amateur career in ice dancing. The other thing I love about Rob is that he has always been a great colleague. So much of his work has involved collaboration with others, which is why he has so many co-authors. Even I am one. And because he is such a great colleague, we are delighted that even after moving to NYU, Rob continues to spend every summer at UCSD. So please join me in welcoming Rob Engel.
Well, thank you, Dick. It's a great pleasure to be back at UCSD. I've spent an awful lot of years here. Every time I'm back, it's different. I could hardly find the Price Center tonight. I was wandering around the new student center, and I thought, you know, I can walk here from the economics department, but I don't know how to drive here. Anyway, tonight I'd like to talk to you a little bit about volatility. Harry was a great warm-up for this, because he told you how important volatility is in understanding the way financial markets really allocate resources. And so I'd like to just start from the place where he took you and go another couple steps further. So I want to talk about risk. And we all sort of have an idea about risk, but basically one of the things that we can see immediately is if we really didn't want to take any risks, we would be hard-pressed to figure out how to live our lives. So naturally we take some risks and others we don't take. And the calculation that we go through is a little bit complicated because we have to decide which risks are worth taking and which risks are not worth taking. And this turns out to be the central paradigm of finance. Which risks are worth taking and which ones are not? If there's no risk, financial markets don't really work. And so the risk is a key part of the way financial markets go. So how do we measure risk and how do we see this risk-return trade-off? Well, this is a question that's been around a long time, and the Nobel Prize Committee has given many awards for contributions on the risk-return trade-off. And Harry's paper in 1952 really set the stage for many future contributions, including Tobin and Sharp, who also identified the risk of a portfolio with its variance, or volatility. As we now know, volatility is the square root of the variance of the returns on this portfolio. And more recently, the Nobel Prize Committee also gave Nobels to Myron Scholes and Bob Merton for their development of the theory of option pricing. And it turns out, when you think about an option, if you think about it as a way of avoiding risk by buying insurance on your portfolio, it's not surprising that the risk is related to the volatility of the portfolio. So the option pricing formula that is called the Black-Scholes formula is based on volatility as well. But I want to take the story a step further, because when practitioners set about to measure volatilities and correlations, they recognized very quickly that these were not constant over time, that they seemed to change, and that it made a difference when you measured them, how you measured them, over what time period you measured them. And realistically, if you're going to try to form a portfolio that you form today that's going to have some performance in the future, you need also to be able to forecast things like volatilities and correlations. So that was another level of complexity that immediately arose. And so the solution that the ARCH model proposes is that instead of doing something simple like using a shorter amount of data set, we can use a data set where we emphasize the most recent information and discount the past information. That's likely to be a better estimate of what the next period's volatility is going to be than a simple average. Now, that doesn't actually sound like much of an innovation, and in fact, it probably really isn't. What it turns out is useful is that you can figure out how much to discount the past by looking at the performance of these kinds of models econometrically. And so the idea that you can model something like volatility, which we don't actually directly observe, as a statistical problem opened the door to all sorts of different applications. And many of the applications are widely used today. So what actually is this model that we're talking about? It's called the ARCH model, and ARCH is a lot easier thing to say than what ARCH stands for, because ARCH stands for autoregressive conditional heteroscedasticity. And that turns out to be quite a challenge even for my PhD students. So we typically call it the ARCH model. It has really it focuses on two features of typical financial data. The first is what we call volatility clustering, and the second is mean reversion. So volatility clustering means that when you have a period of high volatility, it tends to stay high for a little while. And when you have a period of low volatility, it tends to be low for a little while. Mean reversion says, high volatility tends to come down, low volatility tends to come up. Sounds like rocket science, right? Well, it turns out with these simple features, all you need to have is a couple of parameters to describe how long the volatility clusters last and how fast they mean revert to give you a way of measuring volatility and forecasting what it's going to do in the future. And as you build these kinds of models, we started with the ARCH model. I started with the ARCH model, but now the state of the art uses something called a generalized ARCH model or a threshold generalized ARCH model. And this list would go on for about 20 or 30 different kinds of variations on the ARCH model, which are designed to pick up particular features of the financial world. So, because I'm the next to youngest Nobel Prize winner, I'm going to show you sort of what it looked like. So this is what happens in Stockholm. And you see here in the front row are Clive and I on the end of the row, because economics is always at the end of the row. Clive, we are so sad, is not with us anymore. He passed away a year and a half ago. And this moment is a moment that we both look back on, I'm sure, with a great deal of poignance, because we're sitting there wondering what is this going to really mean for the rest of our careers, for our lives. What did we do to get to this point? How is it all going to affect us? But actually, I don't think the audience was paying so much attention to us. I think the audience was actually watching the royal family, who was on the other side of the stage. And certainly my son was quite entranced with the crown princess, whom he thought seemed like she had a very nice personality and would be a great person to get to know. Unfortunately, she already had a boyfriend. But in any case, the king then presents the award, and my wife congratulated me in front of Alfred Nobel, who is sort of looking on with a vaguely disapproving look. And this is what the Nobel Prize really looks like. So, how do we use this ARCH model? We'd all like to know what the stock market is going to do tomorrow. And we also know that it's nearly impossible to predict what the stock market is going to do tomorrow. So what is it that the ARCH model can actually do? The idea is that even though we can't predict what the stock market is going to do, we can't predict the mean of it, we can actually predict some interval that the stock market will lie within, a sort of a confidence interval. That is, we can tell that the stock market is unlikely to go up more than a certain amount or down more than a certain amount tomorrow based on observable data using a model like the ARCH model. And this is actually the basic idea behind many risk models. Risk models use something called value at risk, and this tells you sort of how much are you possibly going to lose in the stock market tomorrow if you're invested in this asset. So here's some pictures that we can look at. So this is an example of forming this interval. So the blue curve is the stock market return measured by the S&P 500 every day from 1990 till August of 2007. And the green and the red curves are the predictions from a Gartz model of what the upper and lower limit really ought to look like. In fact, it's three standard deviations above and three standard deviations below what the return is. So every day, you could come up with a sort of a forecast of what this interval really looks like. And you see the low volatility period of the middle 90s is much smaller than during the internet bubble at this period. And then we have a period of low volatility again in 2003 through 2007. The bottom curve is basically a measure of how much risk is being taken in this market. How much are you likely to lose tomorrow in the stock market is measured by this red curve. And so you can see we can calculate every day how risky it is to be in the stock market. How much could you reasonably lose in if the using this measure of standard deviation? But of course, you might wonder, why did I stop in August of 07, and what would this have done during the financial crisis to help us out? So if we look at the next slide, we'll see the same picture from August 07 till, the last September, something like that. And you can see the red and the green curves now go down to minus 10 or minus almost minus 15% for the three standard deviations. So that it's gotten much wider. But in fact, the blue curve still lies within this confidence interval almost everywhere in here. And so from the point of view of this kind of risk measure, we were not surprised during the financial crisis. That's a little bit of a surprise, because there's got to be something that we didn't really account for. So hold that thought for a moment and come back to it. So what I want to show you is a couple of pictures from a website that we do now at New York University. It's called VLAB, which is a volatility laboratory. Maybe that's because I was once a scientist that we call it a laboratory. But in any case, the idea is that if you take these models and you really believe in them, then it's interesting to see what they do day after day after day, to follow them in real time. So VLAB computes estimates of the volatilities and forecasts of volatilities for several hundred assets every day. Also does correlations and some other kinds of systemic risk measures that could be of interest. So what do we see when we look at the VLAB? And actually, we could do it right here, but I'm not going to do that. So we see, first of all, in the bottom, the same blue returns that we were looking at before. This is 2 years of data. We see in green what's happened to the S&P 500 over the last 2 years, which is mostly went up, and then it went down, and then went up again. And the curve in red is the volatility calculated by using the Garch model. It's a prediction one day ahead of what the volatility would be. So this is like the bottom curve in the chart that I showed you. And you can see that the risk was much higher during the tail end of the financial crisis. It came down. We have this big episode of rising volatilities, which was last May, which was associated with the Greek sovereign debt crisis in Europe and the question of whether the Eurozone was actually going to collapse or not. And then it came back down again. And at the moment, volatility is just about as low as it was during the middle 2000s or the middle 90s. Rather surprising. We also show, for comparison, the volatility index, or VIX, which is an option market-based estimate of the same thing, of volatility. And you see that's, on average, just a little bit higher. But it's especially higher in this period where the options market seems to think that the risks going forward are higher than the underlying asset appears to think. Just two other pictures here. Here are some U.S. sectors. Financial sector is here in red. You see how its volatility went up much faster than these other three sectors on the same plot. But it's come back down, and they're sort of the same. The black is consumer staples, and that never got to be nearly as volatile as the financial sector. And right at the very end, you see the blue curve is now jumping up a bit. What is the blue curve? Well, that's energy. And when we see the Middle East crisis and people talking about what's happening to the price of oil, That's what's moving the stock prices of energy assets, and their volatility is going up just right at the end here. And so we can see this because this is, well, this is from yesterday, so we can get kind of a real-time picture of what's happening. Finally, I have a picture of some commodities, and so if we want to take that idea, here's the ETF, the SPDR of oil and gas exploration in red. See, that was highly volatile at the back end of the financial crisis and has come back down, and now we see it rising just over the last maybe week or two. But interestingly, there's this green sector which has had higher volatility for the last 2 months. And what is that? That's agricultural commodities. And that, again, is something we've been reading about in the newspaper. The rising price of foods and actually cotton and several other agricultural products shows up in these volatility graphs. So it's an easy thing to look at. And some of you may be invested in gold because that's, in some respects, an asset that promises stability. But you can see that the gold here also has volatility, and it has volatility that changes over time. Here's the volatility of the gold. It was never as volatile as these sector stocks, but over time its volatility goes up and down, and here it went up quite a bit during this last fall, but now it is actually a little bit lower than the other. So we can track a lot of different interesting things. So with all this technology, were we prepared? Well, we can go back and ask this question in VLAB, because we do this every day, so we can see how did it do through the financial crisis. And what it turns out is that the financial crisis did not make the models break down. They performed just about the same way in the financial crisis as they do on average in other time periods. But that's forecasting one day ahead. And the problem is that risk management typically uses measures of risk that are forecasting the risk one day ahead. And yet that doesn't give us much warning for when there's a financial crisis coming. It especially doesn't give us much warning for using for this to choose how much to buy of illiquid assets. And when we looked to see how it was doing at forecasting 1 month ahead, the model showed some deterioration during the financial crisis. So we can expect that longer horizon forecasts did deteriorate during the financial crisis, didn't give us as much warning as we would have liked to have had. And I think it's a topic for research that we need to develop improved long-run volatility forecasts and long-run risk forecasts. So what is the difference between a short-run forecast and a long-run forecast? Well, if you're investing in an asset that you can't sell very easily, and we might think about subprime tranches of housing, all these sorts of illiquid assets that became very famous during the financial crisis, we should use measures of risk that are more long run. And the value at risk that we typically calculate is too short run. What's the difference? In the long run, there is a risk that the risk will change. And that's just what happened. The volatility went up during the financial crisis, correlations went up, and the portfolio that you thought was nicely diversified at one point was no longer so diversified, and you were taking much more risk than you thought. So at Stern, my colleagues and I wrote a book on the financial crisis where we talked a lot about these different aspects. In fact, we had so much fun doing that, we've written another one. The second one is a book about the Dodd-Frank bill, which we published last fall, even though the bill only came out last summer. And it's our sort of economic analysis of the different components of the Dodd-Frank bill. And as the rules are being written to implement Dodd-Frank, it's fascinating to see which points are being emphasized and which ones are not. So what is the view coming out of this? Well, is this what we're going to see, or is this what we're going to see? Dancing with Barack. Okay. Well, let me just say a few more things about good ideas, because that's the theme of this evening, and it's the theme of this anniversary celebration. And I think I better rush because I'm taking a lot of time. But I think it's very interesting to think about good ideas, not just Nobel good ideas, but our own good ideas. We have good ideas all the time, and I think if we pay attention to them, it's a real pleasure in organizing our lives. So I want to say just a few words about what I think are the properties of good ideas and what do they look like. So in my case, the Arch model was something that was in the background when I was on sabbatical at the London School of Economics. I was working on another problem, and my wonderful PhD student, Mark Watson, sent me a letter. It was letters those days. He wanted to work on that topic. So reluctantly, I agreed, and I started thinking about the Arch model. Well, thank you, Mark. That was great. He's gone on to have a great career and is a very famous economist, but not in the Arch model. So what was I thinking about? Milton Friedman proposed the hypothesis in his Nobel lecture that business cycles were a result not of the price level, but about the uncertainty of the price level. If you don't know what you're going to be able to sell your goods for, or what you're going to have to pay for labor, then you're likely not to invest so much. So this is kind of why businessmen might not invest when there's a lot of uncertainty about the future, and that would be a cause for a business cycle. So I thought that would be a very interesting thing to investigate, but I didn't know how to measure uncertainty that changed over time. Well, you can see that's exactly what we talked about in financial markets, uncertainty that changes over time, but it happens in real markets as well, and that was the impetus for this. I also was interested, Clive was working on bilinear models, and he had a test for a bilinear model, which I adapted for the Arch model, and there was a whole time series literature that I could use to work these details out. Well, over the next few years at UCSD, David Lillian and Russ Robbins and I worked on the risk-return trade-off and invented a variation on the Arch model, the Arch and Mean model. There were papers that suddenly appeared in Finance that developed this. My students in a whole range of students began a research program in financial econometrics. UCSD sponsored an econometrics research group that for Clive, Hal White, and I, which provided wonderful research opportunities for us to develop the ideas that we were doing both in Arch and in our other areas we were working. I ended up being speaking at various financial institutions, consulting projects, learning about finance. I organized some conferences here on volatilities, and the whole thing just kind of developed over a sort of a decade into this big research enterprise. And now, after 25 years at UCSD, I moved to NYU to be in a finance department because my interests had switched so much to finance. This was before the Rady School was here. And now I'm ending up meeting with practitioners and regulators on lots of different things, and this has actually turned out to be a fascinating experience. I run the Volatility Institute at NYU, and I am a co-founding president of the Society for Financial Econometrics, which is a new, very exciting organization, which is now holding its fourth annual meeting in Chicago in a couple of months. But what about these good ideas? I always like simple ideas. In fact, Einstein has a great quote, as simple as possible, but no simpler. Well, that's a nice idea. I sort of remember in ninth grade when I tried to explain to my science teacher that the formula for how fast something would fall, or how far it would fall, that had a square in it. Time squared times the force of gravity. I mean, and that this was too complicated. It couldn't have been right. Nature wouldn't have done something like that. So, I mean, I think we do make mistakes thinking about things are really simpler than they are, but the idea of simplicity is very important, I think. Good ideas come from looking at one problem from the point of view of another. A good idea has legs. When you apply it to one area and then extend it to someplace else, it may have important implications that you hadn't thought of. A good idea today may seem trivial tomorrow. I think that's surprisingly often true, but that doesn't mean it's not a good idea. Good ideas pop into mind at conferences or odd times or when having a conversation or even in class. Good ideas come from a relaxed mind, and they often come from attempts to disprove something else. That's the origin of Clive's invention of co-integration, as he tells it. Universities are incubators of good ideas. Students bring us good ideas, often laden with irrelevancies, but we help them figure out how to make these good ideas work, how to develop them. They write papers, they get jobs, they become active faculty members, and good ideas are the currency of the PhD student. But it's not just the PhD student, it's the faculty. With a good idea, we write research papers and give lectures. We attract students, we attract collaborators, we organize conferences and international meetings focused on these good ideas, and we develop more and more aspects of these ideas. Universities, when they are sources of good ideas, they are successful in raising funds from granting agencies. They're successful in drawing in the community, such as tonight, and growing the enterprise. They are successful in attracting the best students and in attracting the best faculty. And then, from all these faculty and students, we get more new ideas. So UCSD, I believe, is a great example of this incubation and performance of the role of generating ideas through excellence of its faculty and excellence of its students. It certainly was critical for me, my experience at UCSD and their support of my research and development. So I want to thank all of you and thank UCSD. So here, it's true, we could clap at that. Thank you, UCSD. I'm just about done, but there's a couple quotes here that I think are kind of fun. The universe is full of magical things, waiting patiently for our wits to grow sharper. To see what is in front of one's nose requires a constant struggle. And to select well among old things is almost equal to inventing new ones. So, thank you all for coming tonight. We count on you to help us be good incubators. And I hope you go home with some good ideas. And sometime join me in my favorite spot for coffee, the Arch Cafe. Thank you.